Hello everyone, welcome to the 9th episode of the AJSP Editors Podcast. This is Kim Pon Tem, the host of the podcast. We have two more hosts here, Angela Leung and Sammy Khan. We started this podcast in 2021, and we're now in the third year. We have two objectives doing this episode. First is to introduce publications in our journal to the global or psychology or social psychology community. Second, to nurture the next generation of Asian social psychologists. In each episode, we have two sections, editor's pick and special topic discussion. Now, without further delay, let's begin with our editor's pick.
Hey, yeah, thanks, Kevin, for introducing the session. I have chosen one paper for this episode's editor's pick. The title of the paper is called Taking Control of Violence Against Doctors. This paper includes a series of five studies led by Qian Yang from the Zhejiang University School of Medicine. So this research was motivated by some alarming evidence that violence against healthcare professionals has been becoming quite prevalent in China. So according to some statistics cited by the authors, out of the 588 nurses sampled from the Heilongjiang province, 80% of them actually reported experiencing physical or non-physical violence committed by the patients or the patient's relatives in the preceding year. And also 50% of the 2,500 medical providers from the Fujian and Henan provinces reported at least one incident of patient-inflicted violence in the preceding year. So it is in this context that the research was motivated in adopting an evidence-based intervention approach to examine the phenomenon of violence against doctors. So the authors applied the theoretical approach of motivated scapegoating to shed light on this phenomenon. So as medical patients, we know that they are likely to experience uncertainty and some potential negative outcomes of the diagnosis. So they or the family members may choose to manage this negative situation by blaming the doctor or using the doctor as scapegoats to compensate for the loss of control. So with the logic that lack of control may contribute to doctor blaming and violence, the authors further argued that promoting perceived control of patients and the family members can lower blaming and violent intentions towards doctor. So in this light, the research team conducted a series of five studies to achieve the goal. So studies 1A and 1B were correlational studies. So they start with some correlational analysis to test whether perceived lack of control is associated with greater tendencies to blame the doctors. So the sample of study 1A was recruited from a children's hospital. So the participants were father of a sick child. The sample of study 1B was a community sample. So both samples completed the perceived lack of control measure. Then next, the participants read some scenarios about a patient receiving a hasty diagnosis from the doctor. And they were asked to wait two explanations. One explanation had to do with blaming the doctor and the other explanation, not blaming the doctor. So across these two studies with different samples, consistent with the scapegoating hypothesis, feelings of lack of control predicted participants' tendency to blame the doctor. So as the first two studies have gathered correlational evidence, the research team then carried out study two with an experimental approach that manipulated two variables in a between subjects design. So the first variable was disease cause that is either chaotic or not chaotic. And the second variable was disease outcome that is either positive or negative. So these manipulations were done in a scenario. Participants read about a scenario in which a patient had a certain experience in the hospital. And the key finding is that there was a significant interaction between disease cause and disease outcome, where participants were more likely to blame the doctor when the disease cause was chaotic than not chaotic, if the disease outcome turned out to be worse. So in other words, it is the unpredictable nature of the disease and not just its negative valence that drives the scapegoating attributions. I think that the study ended with a very interesting intervention approach to temporarily affirm patient's sense of personal control in order to see whether this affirmed sense of control can lower participants' frustration and aggression against doctors. So study 3A recruited guardians of children And study 3B recruited participants in a maternity hospital. So participants were randomly assigned to one of the conditions. So one condition was the elevated control condition. So they wrote about two things they could control in their life. The other group of the participants were in the baseline condition. So they just wrote about two recent events in their life. Then they indicated the frustration to the doctor and the violent intentions against the doctor. For example, they waited on the statement, "I have an impulse to hit the doctor." And results show that frustration with doctors mediated the effect of control intervention on reducing violent intentions. That is, reminding participants a sense of control could lower their frustration towards the doctor, which in turn lowered their intentions to act violently. So taken together, the five studies show a consistent evidence that doctors tend to be scapegoat target when people dispositionally lack control or when people situationally experience lower control if the disease is framed as unpredictable and negative. That is a summary of the five studies reported in the paper. I chose this paper because I like it a lot. It exemplifies how a theory can provide a coherent basis for a set of studies. So it has altogether five studies in this manuscript. So the theoretical account of motivated scapegoating first provides support for predicting correlation between lack of control and the tendency to blame doctors. And this correlational finding then provides the foundation for manipulating the key mechanism of lack of control in causing patients scapegoating attributions. And it also ends with a test of application to showcase how an intervention of inducing a sense of perceived control can reduce frustration and violent intent towards the doctor. So I think an important strength of this paper is that there's a very strong theoretical thread connecting the multiple studies. So yeah, that's my view on this paper. And I'm sure Sammy and Kevin, you have your own perspective on the paper. So I can share with us what you think.
I really agree with your assessment of the paper. I think it's a very strong paper. And what sticks out from reading it, the really strong theoretical framework and a very well-crafted rationale and contextualization of the research or contextual justification of the research, drawing on statistics on aggression towards healthcare workers in China. And what I like about it the most about the research itself is the mixed methods and the triangulation of both research designs and different samples addressing the exact same phenomena. So that is what I would say would be the greatest strength of the paper.
For me, I think, first of all, I agree with Angela's and Sammy's assessment. If anything, I would add that I really like papers with multiple studies, right? That's my general preference. And given the importance of replications, right? We know that we are now facing a crisis, right? We have been talking about replicability of crisis. And then that's the important thing to consider from an author's perspective. Don't rush to publish your findings from a single study. Always think about, plan your research ahead, with a program of studies, how to, using the words that we just used, triangulate, right? Triangulation of different methods and different samples, different procedures, method designs, and how you can, very stringently test your idea. We generally now show this preference towards multi-study paper. Obviously, as a reader, you also find papers like this more convincing than those with only a single study. So that's one, of course, the very nice thing about this paper. And of course, these studies are strongly connected to each other, right? It's not just a bunch of studies, but very carefully planned, obviously. And I also like the writing of the paper in particular, in terms of how the writing is informed by not only theories, but also very rich description or understanding, obviously, of what's happening in the real world in terms of these incidents in which people blame or even act aggressively towards doctors and other medical professionals. That's a real world problem, right? And this is paper not just about theories, it's also about a real world problem. And then the writing very effectively connect these theories with a real-world problem. And in the end, you can find interesting theoretical significance from the findings, but at the same time, you could also learn something that could be useful for solving these real-world problems. I think the writing is very effective in doing that. Yeah, that these are the two things I like a lot in the paper.
I just want to add to that, because I think this paper also highlights the significance of social psychology for a range of different societal and social processes. So it may seem like, well, why are we publishing something that relates to medical contexts in a social psychology journal? But for me, that really highlights the relevance of social psychological theory and research in addressing some of these processes at play.
Yeah, I completely agree with both of your perspectives. So the important strength of the paper is to see how theories can be actually applied in the real world. So I want to see like what are the improvements that we can suggest to the authors if they want to maybe follow up with another study, because the paper is already very neat. All the multiple different studies are closely connected. So it's quite hard for me to think of further improvements. But one thing I can think of maybe to further improve the scenario-based methodology of the study, because currently all the studies in the paper tend to be scenario-based, right? Because participants were asked to respond to a scenario and then indicate the intention to do something. So it's kind of hypothetical. So maybe a very promising future research direction is to bring the study of violence against doctors to the field, like to the actual hospital setting. Maybe researchers can consider examining the effects of other means of affirming patients and the family members a sense of control in the actual hospital context, right? Instead of asking them to think of recent incidents that they have control in their life, maybe they can give them control in the hospital by maybe sharing information about the disease with them and also giving them the opportunities and time to talk to the doctor. So I think this can give them a sense of control. It's not like so uncertain or unpredictable that they don't know anything about the diagnosis. They can have this kind of communication channel in place. Then researchers can consider conducting an interrupted time series design to check scapegoating behaviors against the doctors before and after these communication channels are put into place. So I think a few studies like that, tracking the changing behaviors or changing violence against doctors before and after these kind of communication channels are put into place to affirm a sense of control toward the patients, can further strengthen the contributions of this research. So yeah, that is something I could think of if we can suggest to others to make another improvement for further future directions. Yeah, so Kevin or Sammy, what are your suggestions to the authors?
I agree. In terms of the paper and the research presented in the paper, I don't actually have that many suggestions, because I think they do a really good job at getting so many studies into one paper. They touch upon the practical implications, but I think I would have liked to have seen a bit more there, but I know there would have been space restraint there. But actually how we go from proof of evidence to actually developing, testing an intervention that translates this into something that gives patients a sense of control in medical context. I had to think about that, and it's not my area of expertise, so I probably didn't do a good job in terms of brainstorming that for myself, but I would have liked to have had a little bit more thought shared with me about how one maybe go upon giving patients in medical context control, because this is done in kind of in an experimental research design, but actually how would one do this in a hospital? In terms of future directions, I think there is potential there for testing a range of other mediators or potentially moderators, such as trust in healthcare professionals, but also literacy that patients have about the disease and the nature of the disease that they're faced with, and beliefs about the controllability of disease. So I think there are many different mediators, moderators, and other factors that could be taken into account to paint a bigger empirical picture of what the different factors are that may dampen versus increase aggression in those type of situations. A good piece of research, in my opinion, is one that stimulates one in that way, that it makes you think that actually there are all these other factors that may be relevant, and we could build on this in interesting ways. So that's what I would say, is that I would like to see more reflection on the interventions, and in terms of future research, consider other mediators. And I do know that they had a free choice attribution as well. So it would have been interesting to get some insight into the nature of that data as well.
As Angela and Sammy said it already, I think this paper is very strong. So I don't have any kind of suggestions for improvement, but maybe I can talk about some future directions I would like to see. And obviously, we have to see kind of the study being replicated or extended to other sociocultural contexts. Another thing is, if the effect here is about sense of control, you know, people blame the doctor, people may show violence against the doctor because of the loss of sense of control. So how about something else that could help people regain their sense of control? Could it be also used as a kind of like an intervention to improve doctor and patient relationship and to avoid this kind of a conflict or even violence between them? Something like, for example, religious belief, for example, which for some people, this is a way through which they can restore a sense of control about the happenings on them. So is it possible that for religious people, they're less likely to attribute blame of their illness to the doctor, and then as a result, show a reduced intention to be aggressive towards the doctor? Or is it possible that using some experimental procedures to see whether engagement in certain religious practices, prayers, for example, would be useful in restoring kind of a sense of control in the patients, and as a result, reduce the possibility of blaming the doctor or violence against the doctor. So I'm quite interested in seeing how the psychological process in discussing this paper may interact with other psychological processes that are known to be related to sense of control. So that's my little suggestion for this research. All right, so that's the discussion about this very interesting paper, Taking Control of Violence Against Doctors. Obviously, we three of us would recommend you to strongly to read this specific paper. Well, of course, also spend some time reading other papers in this recent issue of the journal. They're all so very interesting. So I stop here. When we are back, we move to this special topic discussion. Welcome back to the second part of our episode today, special topic discussion. And the topic today is qualitative research in social psychology. Why this topic? I suppose you may know that our field, social psychology, is predominantly quantitative, right? Some of us did not even receive training in qualitative methods. And obviously, most of the publications in our journal and other social psychological journals are quantitative. But we believe that against this backdrop, the predominance of quantitative research, qualitative methods still play a very important role in the development of sociopsychological knowledge. So we want to take this episode, this special topic discussion, as an opportunity to discuss, first of all, the relevance and importance of qualitative research in social psychology, and then for our journal, how we evaluate manuscripts reporting qualitative research. Regarding the latter, we have the observation that some of the submissions we received at AJSP we're kind of weak in terms of theorization and methodological rigor. So that's also a good opportunity for us to discuss what makes a good qualitative research papers. Hopefully it will be useful for authors, for listeners. Our guest today is Professor Wendy Lee. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
Wendy is Associate Professor of Psychology and also Associate Dean of Research of James Cook University in Australia. We have been working with each other for some time already, as Wendy is now one of our associate editors. She's basically almost our go-to person, right, for manuscripts reporting qualitative research. Right? She's the first person we'll go to when we have this kind of manuscripts we need to handle. So Wendy, so let's start with the very first question. That's basically a question to be asked every one of our guests, and that is something more personal, right? The question is, how did you fall in love with social psychology? How did your social psychology journey begin?
Thank you so much, Kevin. My first training in psychology was back to many, many years ago in China. And I was trained as an educational psychologist. As you know, in Asian countries, we all love to explore education from a psychological perspective. It was when I moved to New Zealand in 2003, I started to work with problem gamblers, in Asian communities, and also started my research master looking at Chinese international students' gambling issues. That was my first qualitative paper and also my first social psychology research project. Because I found even for international students, they have lots of issues with their study in education. And all the issues seems to link with social and cultural factors. For example, some students, they drop out and they fail because they were involved in problem gambling. Why? Because they feel lonely in the new educational system and the new country. So that's why I started to look at the social and cultural factors playing in education, and found it's just fascinating. And that was the time I started my qualitative training as well.
Okay. So thanks for sharing this story. I think definitely we have more questions about this qualitative research. It must be very useful in your view, right, in understanding these international students' right, experiences. So let's start with a very broad question about qualitative research then. And that is, what exactly is qualitative research, right? Now, given that our field is dominated by quantitative research, I think in some graduate programs, qualitative methods are not even taught, right? So maybe for some, they're not very familiar with the idea of qualitative research. So what exactly is that? And how is it similar to or different from quantitative research? What are the relative advantages or disadvantages?
I think the similarity that both qualitative and quantitative studies, scientific studies, because some even ask me, is a qualitative study scientific? Is it empirical study? Of course it is. But the big difference is we are all familiar with quantitative study. We look at numbers. But in qualitative studies, we look at text. We look at stories. We look at recordings, for example, audio and video recordings, and we look at images as well. So this is the big difference between two research methods or methodologies. And also, I think we are familiar that when we look at generalization in quantitative study, of course, there's the statistical generalization. But in qualitative study, it's more about theoretical generalization. Every research with the same data may have different interpretations. I will talk about the importance of interpretations later on. But it needs to make sense theoretically or conceptually rather than just something from our mind, just put whatever we think is the analysis, actually is not. And also, I think qualitative study provide a very comprehensive understanding of nuanced experience. For example, the experience connect our present to our past. And this is quite difficult to capture in quantitative studies. We almost focus on, for example, the state of something, state of the outcome. But in the qualitative studies, from the stories, we are quite easy to connect our present to our past and also our future to our present and our past.
On this note about connecting the present to the past, I suppose you're talking about, you know, when you interview people, you let them talk about this, the connection. So yes, based on what the person tells you.
Yes. For example, we look at the history of the person. And for example, in my PhD study, I look at older Chinese migrants' experience in New Zealand, in the new country. So of course, we look at the history of their migration process, what brought them to New Zealand. And from that, we can look at lots of stories related to their past. And also from their stories, we can see how they connect their present to the past. Of course, the connection may not be obvious in the narrative, but through the interpretation of the researcher or the research team, then the connection could be established.
Yeah, so Wendy, I have this question in my mind, because given AJSP's focus on social psychology, so in your view, why are qualitative methods important for social psychology? So how does research on personality and social psychological processes benefit from the use of qualitative methods? And also because social psychologists tend to be more familiar with quantitative methods. So when should social psychologists consider using qualitative methods in their research?
Thank you so much, Angela. I think for the importance, for example, social psychology, we look at group interaction between within the group or between the groups. And also personality, we try to know about the person. And when we try to understand the person, actually, we try to understand their narrative. And also for intergroup or within group interactions, it's all about the world. And we live in a storied world. We always understand the world through the stories. For example, I always told my students, for those psychologists, that we don't sit down with our clients and then ask them to answer the questionnaire and then we show them the SPSS. But we try to understand their stories. So that's why I think in social psychology, it's so important to understand the person's stories and narrative and try to understand the person.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So it's like qualitative methods is good for story building, right? To understand people's history and also build a narrative around the lives. Maybe the audience may be interested in finding out some concrete examples. Right? So would you mind giving us some concrete examples of research, maybe your own work or other people's work you are familiar with, so that the audience have some idea of how qualitative methods can be applied in social psychology research?
Sure. And for example, I use my PhD study as an example. And I published a paper in gardening. And this is something I never, ever planned to write in my thesis or my publication. But it was so interesting because I interviewed 34 older migrants. Everyone talk about their Chinese vegetable. For example, they talk about in the first 2 years, they grew Chinese vegetable for saving money. But after 2 years, the government social welfare system give them some, for example, weekly living cost. But they still grow their Chinese vegetable. So I start to ask the question, what does it mean by the Chinese vegetable for the participants? And they emphasize again and again, my vegetable garden is Chinese vegetable. These are the Chinese seeds rather than New Zealand vegetable, New Zealand seed. And they brought the seed from China or get some seed from their friends. And then they talk about how to grow the vegetable. And the vegetable blossom and growing up very well and putting the roots in the soil. So this is the key point I use as a metaphor. When they putting the vegetables roots into the soil, into the New Zealand soil, the actually they are rooting themselves. So this is the interpretation I use for their rooting. And also they mentioned that when they were in China, particularly for that age group, they went during the cultural evolutional movement. They were sent to countryside and to be re-educated. And they talk about in countryside, they, for example, they were university professors and writers, managers, but they were all in the countryside to grant Chinese vegetable. So they mentioned it again and again. Then you can see the connection. And also they mentioned discrimination they experienced in their everyday life. For example, when they could not speak English well, people looked at them with very strange facial expression. They feel that they were not respected by others. Then they talk about they returned to home and went to the garden, talked to the Chinese vegetables in Chinese. Which means that when they talk to the vegetable in Chinese, they didn't experience discrimination. And, you know, they live with their children. So have lots of arguments, of course, three generations living together. And they talk about when they were upset after the argument with their children, they went to the garden, talked to the vegetable as well. So you can see actually that's the vegetable tell them to heal the difficulties they experience in their everyday life. So from then, I asked again and again, what does it mean by the story to those participants? And then I come up with a very beautiful article talking about growing Chinese vegetable as a way to construct the a hybrid identity for those participants.
Well, that's a very, very illustrative example of the usefulness of these qualitative methods, right? The stories that you just told us. It's very interesting. So if you don't mind, you can share the link to the paper with us later, and we can put it in the description of our episode so our listeners can easily assess the articles. I personally would like to read that too, right? And I think that it's quite obvious that there's something that's not really possible to be uncovered with surveys, right? It's a lot of talking and conversations that you uncover these kind of the importance of these Chinese vegetables for these migrants, right?
Yes, absolutely. And when we listen to their stories, we also record, for example, in the research journal, we record their facial expression as well. So that we will understand better from their facial expression. That's something we cannot capture in survey at all.
So we know with all research, there's always, research can be very hard. And given that we have already identified that qualitative research is quite different than doing quantitative research, what are some common challenges in conducting qualitative research?
I think there are a couple of challenges. One, of course, is very time consuming. For example, the interviews we conducted, maybe it lasts. Yeah, every interview lasts more than 2 or 3 hours. I still remember the longest interview I had for my PhD project was 4.5 hours. I really wanted to stop, but the participant just keep talking. They just didn't want to stop. I understand, because I think I was the only one to listen to them and did not have any judgment on them against them. So they were very comfortable to talk to me. So related to the length of the interview is the transcribing. In old days, it's so difficult to do the transcribing, particularly for research project related to minority or using a language other than English. For example, I transcribe it in Chinese and then I need to translate it into English. So that's very, very time consuming. I think with the development of technology, it becomes much, much easier, because now whatever language you have, you can use the transcribing and software. And so it's much, much easier. But one thing I would like to remind our readers or our listeners is about the ethical consideration. What kind of software you can use? And please consult with the HRE's, the ethical committee, what software we should use, because there is no guarantee that every software, particularly the online one, can maintain the integrity of our research. So this is the very time consuming, I have to say. But of course, quantitative study are time consuming as well, because we need the big sample. And also during the process, the challenge is to keep the research journal. Because for some of the researchers, particularly for experienced researchers, they may not keep the research journal. But I would like to recommend after each interview, for example, if I did the interview myself, after I return to my car, I always write down everything I remember. For example, the interaction between myself and the participants, the facial and body language, and the setting of the interview room, and particularly if not. For example, it's not in a meeting room, in their home, and or in a place that both the researcher and the participants agree on. What's the setting? And this is something that I think sometimes is quite challenging as well, because all this are the part of the data as well for our analysis. And in the analysis process, I think the most difficult thing actually is the interpretation. Because from my observation of journal submission, as well as my examination in PhD or master thesis, and I can see that many researchers do not interpret the data, just to put whatever they think and list all the quotations in the result session, and then put whatever they think in the discussion. Sometimes I can't even find the word in their discussion. Why? Because without interpretation, It's just like if we use quantitative as an example, quotation in qualitative study are the raw data. Mm-hmm. And for example, we cannot just present the raw data in quantitative study. But in qualitative study, I can see many researchers just present the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, list 5 quotation under the theme as the result session without any interpretation. Just like we just list those numbers in qualitative study. Mm. Will this quantitative paper be accepted? Of course not. Mm. So this is the most challenging part, how to interpret the data, the qualitative data, the test, with the support from theory.
Well, thanks, Wendy, for these very detailed comments regarding, you know, the common challenges of conducting qualitative research, right? And of course, they mentioned this very important reminder about research ethics, right? And of course, the later part of your answer is related very well to the next question, next set of questions we want to ask you, because we were talking about, you know, how researchers conduct a qualitative research and report their findings in the manuscript. And that's essentially something they also have to talk about today, in terms of how we evaluate manuscripts while reporting qualitative research. I don't know why, but some authors have a wrong impression that AJSP, our journal, doesn't consider qualitative research at all, right? And from time to time, we receive queries from authors on this matter, right? Do you accept qualitative papers, etc.? The fact is, we do consider qualitative research, and we have actually published papers using qualitative methods, although kind of occasionally, right? But the answer is we do consider qualitative research. And Wendy helps us to evaluate a lot of these manuscripts we received using qualitative methods. So it's a very good opportunity now, right, to ask Wendy to share with us and our listeners. So what a good qualitative research is like, what kind of criteria you use when you evaluate manuscripts reporting qualitative research?
I think the first thing is whether I have the interest in continue reading the manuscript. Mm. If I found that I lost my interest, for example, the introduction is not theoretical strong, then that's one of the first criteria I use. And also I mentioned again and again, interpretation. Mm. So in the result session, I see many of the submissions the thesis I have examined, I can see that people just describe what happened. For example, describe, the participant got up at 6 o'clock and then blah, 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 blah. Then why he got up at 6 o'clock today? And his routine is 8 o'clock. So what happened? And this is something always missed in many of the manuscript. For the interpretation, as I mentioned, that it needs to make sense, theoretical sense. And for example, when people read it, oh yes, for example, when we say putting the roots in the New Zealand soil, that's the migration process as well. We try to integrate ourselves in the society so we can put our roots in the society as well. So people will say, oh yes, it makes sense. So I strongly recommend authors read your manuscript again and again to see whether it makes sense. Always ask the question, what does it mean for the participants? And if it's possible, actually, I think for qualitative study, return back to the participants to ask them whether your interpretation makes sense to them. This is something we ignore for a long time, either qualitative or quantitative. We just grab the data and then go away. And we often ignore our participants. Actually, they have their curiosity, what we found. And this is particularly useful for qualitative study. For example, and for my PhD, I actually returned to the community again and again and went to the Chinese Association, those participants there again and again, and present my research findings to ask them, do you agree with that? And also, they actually give me more insights into my data analysis as well. So that's something I think I've never seen a single manuscript in the submission to our journal talking about how they validate their analysis with support from the participants. Actually, that's a very important part for qualitative study. And also that the interpretation, because as I mentioned, interpretation is the analysis. The discussion needs to connect back to the interpretation, and so that it makes sense. And otherwise, for example, some authors, they develop a model from the qualitative data. But I can't even see some of the elements in the data at all. Participants did not use that word about in the elements, in the factors, in the model, and no interpretation. And we do not expect we just list 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 quotations and then leave the readers or the editors to interpret. Oh, yes, this is, I can connect this. No, it's not the manuscript we would like to accept.
The next question I have is quite related to Kevin's point, because as Kevin mentioned, AJSP also received manuscripts using qualitative methods, but some of these papers may not pass the threshold. So Wendy, in your evaluation of those manuscripts, what are the common weaknesses of the manuscripts? And I think this will be important for the prospective authors to know so that they can avoid those weaknesses when they submitted the manuscript.
Yeah, I think one thing is that the manuscript is descriptive, describe what happened rather than interpret what happened. What's the meaning behind that? And also the data collection part, sometimes I see is a little bit weak. For example, some authors use the process just like a quantitative study data collection rather than a qualitative data collection. But for this part, I do not reject based on this. For example, some authors use quantitative language using hypothesis. We hypothesis that, but actually in qualitative studies, we don't have hypothesis. We grounded our theory or our findings from the data. We do not test any hypothesis. But of course, for this part, I will not just reject the paper or the submission. I often wrote back to the author to mind the language used, qualitative language rather than a quantitative language. Yeah, so I think the main thing is the interpretation. This is the central part of a qualitative study, and whether the interpretation is supported by theories on that in this field. So related to this, I actually would like to recommend that for authors in qualitative study, familiarize with the theories and concepts in the field you are studying so that you can borrow the theory to support and also some small concepts to support your understanding. And for example, if I use an example, again, in my PhD studies, and I have a chapter talking about acculturation. And one of the example I use, actually the participants talking about, they organize lots of cultural celebrations, events, and they often send songs with in English and Chinese. So for them, it's quite natural. And then my interpretation, actually, this is a mix of the identity as well, using two languages to show that they are New Zealander as well, but they are still Chinese. And from here, actually, I relate this interpretation with the grafting identity. There's a concept in migration study, grafting identity, which means our mixed, our hybrid identity, just like grafting a plant. To have a new plant being grafted in the old plant, then grow a completely different plant. This is what I mean using the concept, very small concept to support your interpretation. So I use the grafting identity to support. And rather than just describe what happened, for example, oh, they sing the songs, and then what does it mean? Again, coming back to the theory, coming back to the concepts.
Thanks, Wendy. And I think what comes through very clearly is that there are more elements to qualitative research than just reproducing or re-describing what participants are saying. And you have already put forward some suggestions, but I'm thinking, are there ways in which authors can work to ensure that they are producing strong qualitative analysis, strong qualitative papers, or in other words, avoiding some of the weaknesses that are commonly present in manuscripts reporting qualitative research?
So for me, as I recommend, always ask the question, what does it mean for the participants? What does it mean for the participants again and again? And then try to explore the meaning of the story.
That's very good advice. I've done a bit of qualitative research, and having it explicated like that makes it very, very clear to me that it's obviously a key question to ask every time we're analyzing the data.
Yeah, not only once, again and again, ask yourself, what does it mean for the participants? And also talk to the participants, what does it mean for them? Because for qualitative studies, we often have a series of interviews rather than only one interview. So you actually can come back with your interpretation and ask the participants what it means. For example, I still remember a very moving, or very sad, I should say, it's very sad story from my participants. For example, in the first interview, I asked my participants, what does it mean when the word home coming up in your mind? And they always have the very sweet answer, home sweet home. And it's where I can escape difficulties in the outside world. I can always return to get comfort. But the gentleman in the interview, the gentleman mentioned again and again, yeah, after he answered this question with a very sweet answer, but he mentioned again and again, and at least three times, I am one of the Chinese generation that who have experienced so many difficulties in our lifetime, and political or personal. And then I thought, if home is so sweet, why this person mentioned it again and again, the difficulties, and he can stand with any difficulties in his life. So it's until the third interview, I already have established rapport with the participants. I asked the participants, in the first interview, you mentioned that home is a sweet home for you. You can see comfort every time when you return home. But you also mentioned that you are one of the people who can endure any difficulties in your life. And can you give me some of the example about that? And after a long pause, the gentleman said, oh no, home is not a sweet home for me at all. I am not allowed to use computer, and my son-in-law hasn't talked to me for 2 years. So this is something we return it again and again to invite more interpretation or new interpretation of the stories.
We can see now the very importance of the interpretation and then open, continued conversations with your participants. Now with the example you just gave us, that's a very nice example. So here comes the very last question. So I think Wendy shared with us a lot of insights and recommendations already. So I just want to squeeze one more from her. The very last question, asked this on behalf of anyone who is interested in qualitative methods, but who is new to these kind of methods. Just an easy question, okay, simple question. Can you recommend some resources for these people if they really want to begin using qualitative methods? What is the best, maybe book, maybe article, I don't know, the best thing to start?
For example, Norman Denzin's The Sage Handbook of Qualitative Research, I think is the book for every qualitative researchers when they started and to use. And also, Patricia Levy also have another handbook of qualitative study. That's the Oxford Handbook of Qualitative Study Research. And those handbooks, I think they are quite valuable because they are, of course, they are very thick. And they have different parts of, for example, start from the theory and start the philosophy of qualitative study, and then different analysis methods, and also how to design a qualitative study. And how to collect data, what kind of issues you may experience in the data collection, and also how to analyze data using different analysis methods, and how to discuss. So, and also how to work with different populations. And so I think they are quite good. And also there's a SAGE series about qualitative research method series as well. And for this, the series published by SAGE, they are more focused on small topics, and the books are not very thick, a very small book. And for example, how to run a focus group, how to use narrative analysis, how to do narrative interviewing. So I think those books are quite useful as well. For articles, there is a journal, Qualitative Research in Psychology. And yeah, that may be a journal we would like to visit to, yeah, to have all the qualitative studies related to psychology. And also the journal's impact factor is rather high. So the papers are well cited as well.
Thanks a lot for these suggestions. We'll make sure we'll list these resources in the description of the episode here. So it has been a very long discussion. I've used a lot of time from Wendy. Once again, we have to show our appreciation to your time and effort in joining us in this episode and sharing these advice and recommendations with our listeners. And of course, for your continued effort in helping us evaluate manuscripts of the journal. Thanks a lot, Wendy.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy.
So see you all. We'll see you in the next episode. Bye-bye.